People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. And I have a book here called Blood and Silver, A True Story of Survival and a Son's Search for His Family Treasure. It's a memoir by Jan Glazewski. And it intrigued me when it came across my desk because before fleeing the family estate near Lviv in what is now Ukraine, Jan Glazewski's father buried what he could salvage of the family silver in the forest. The Glazewskis left war-ravaged Europe after World War II for a new life here in South Africa. Then Jan was born in Paarl, and he nearly died, like his elder brother before him, of severe haemophilia. And against all odds, he survived childhood, only to discover, at the start of his career, that he is HIV positive from receiving contaminated blood products. Despite the setback, Jan went on to have a remarkable legal and academic career, which we're going to hear about in the course of this interview. So, Jan, welcome to Fine Music Radio. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here, Rodney.
Is this one of the first books you've written, I mean, as regards a novel or a memoir? Because most of your stuff is academic, isn't it?
Exactly. So my other work is academic, environmental law in South Africa. This is my first novel, in inverted commas,
okay.
Actually a memoir.
Was it fun to write? Because it reads like an easy chat, may I say.
Well, it was a long process, and it was fun, and I met lots of lovely people doing it. I went to writing courses, but I never really had an ending for it until I went to look for the silver.
So, in other words, you decided to write a memoir about your life.
Exactly.
And only then decided, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and look for the silver.
Exactly. More or less, I had this urge to sort of disclose or tell people about my life, my difficulties, because they aren't visible.
Yeah.
And I thought it'd be lovely to have this published, but a publisher wouldn't be interested in a book about somebody's difficult life. They'd be interested in
something dramatic.
A treasure hunt.
Yeah, exactly. There you are, a treasure hunt.
So while I was writing, I was dabbling in lots of other things, but I thought I'd never really finish the work unless I gave it a shot.
And hence this book came into being. And I love the story. I mean, everyone likes a good treasure hunt and a mystery. In a sense, it's a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you obviously knew about the silver all your life.
Well, yes. So just picture this. My father, the Polish immigrant from a wealthy land-owning family in Poland, arrives in South Africa penniless, completely new life, different. And he doesn't talk much about what I call his first life. But every now and then he'd tell anecdotes at the dining room table. And one of them that captivated me, and I can't remember exactly when, and it must have been maybe 10 years old around there, about this family silver buried somewhere in now it's Ukraine, but then it was the USSR.
Yes, Soviet that's right.
Union.
The borders
yeah.
changed a lot around there.
Yeah, yeah. After World War II, my parents, my grandfather's estate was in eastern Poland, but after World War II, at Yalta, where Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt met, they moved the border, and Poland lost a lot of the eastern side, including my grandfather's estate and the city of Lviv in Polish. It was Poland before the war, Lwów in Polish, Lviv in English now. And then it became communist, of course, and there was a double reason not to go back to Poland. And my parents then eventually arrived in South Africa.
In a sense, so they chased out of Poland because of the Russian invasion.
Well, as my uncle told me many years later, they were chased out because the Russians were coming, as it were. but my uncle later told me that my mother took the old sheets, expecting to go back. This is a war-ravaged region for centuries. And my mother apparently took the old linen, thinking, there's going to be another war, but we'll go back. And of course, that never happened.
No, of course. And it's interesting because Poland is so important, isn't it, in the start of the Second World War. It's what started the Second World War, the Nazi invasion.
Exactly. That started, yeah. And there's so many similarities of what's happening today with the refugees and so on.
Yes.
But I also wanted to mention, in that summary that you wrote, there's so much in between. And one of them is that my parents left in a hurry. They spent a bit of time in Romania, because then Romania bordered southern Poland, no longer does. My father sold, my late father, a gold-plated cigarette case. He got some money. He started rented a piece of land. He started farming. And then Stalin announced that all Polish refugees in Romania are going to go to Siberia, which many did. But because they had some connections, my parents got onto a boat over the Black Sea, long story, but eventually ended up landing at Haifa. It was then Palestine. In 1947, or maybe 46, I'm not sure. And my father then joined the British Allied Forces. They had a Polish unit in the Middle East, where lots of things happened. Amongst the others, my three older sisters were born.
Right. So you were a family of four. Your older brother, I think, died of hemophilia.
Yes, it's important to tell you that.
Yes.
So I left that out. Very important is when they left Poland, my mother was pregnant. And Adam was born in Romania, and then when he was about one, they noticed that he bled a lot, he was bruised. Hemophilia is a genetic disease that's passed down through the mother usually, but there was no family history. And they diagnosed him as a hemophiliac in Bucharest, in Romania, and he bruised easily, and they had to take special care of him. They got to Haifa, and then a few months later, he had an internal bleed, which is what happens to hemophiliacs in his stomach. He was on the way to hospital, and this is what I hear. He died. So the firstborn in our family was died. And then there were three sisters, and then I was born in Paarl in South Africa.
Are you then the youngest?
I'm the youngest of the original family.
Right, right.
But I can tell you, my family is complicated. My mother died when I was about, I'm leaving a lot out of the story already, but when I was about just turned seven, my mother died. We were then living in Durban on a farm in Durbanville. There's a whole chapter on that in the book, Cotswold Farm.
Right, you called it the Cotswold Farm. I thought,
well, that was the name it came with, but it was so ironic
name.
Because it, my father always said, there were so many stones and it was rocky. I mean, he couldn't afford to buy a farm, he rented a piece of land. And today it is a quarry. My father always said this is good for stones only. Mm-hmm. But my point is that we lived outside the village of Durbanville. After my mother died, my father didn't want to. He struggled to taking me to school. He didn't want me to catch the farm bus because of the roughness for a hemophiliac boy. So he'd have to take me. It was then 7 miles, today about 10 kilometers. He'd have to take me to school and back. And then one day a widow. We used to go to church. We were Catholics, brought up as Catholics. At Sunday Mass, a Mrs. Edwards, who was a widow with 8 of her own children, after Mass, heard the story I heard later, asked my dad how things are going, and he said, I'm struggling taking Jan to school every day. I'm thinking of maybe sending him to Nazareth House for a week. She said, oh, nonsense. He must come and stay with us. I've got my children in the village. She lived in the village of Durbanville. One more won't matter, and I'll just take him to school. So to answer your question, I have three original sisters, a late brother, but then 4 stepbrothers and 4 step-siblings. But that doesn't end the story. Being good Catholics, I think, they had 2 more children. So I have a half-brother and a half-sister. The youngest of the whole family is Adela, who is the mother of Layla, who features in the memoir.
Yes, that's right. Whole diary at the end.
Exactly,
later.
Yeah.
Now, Jan, obviously I want to find out more about the journey and the little bits you might have left out, but I'm intrigued by your first choice of music, which is apparently a Polish carol.
Yes.
Now, you need to tell us a little bit about this, and I don't think I'm going to be able to pronounce the name.
Yes. So why I chose a Polish carol was because we lived on this farm in Cotswold. We spoke Polish at home. I was Polish then. Hadn't learned English properly. My second language is Afrikaans because I spoke with, if I can call them, colored laborers' children. Mm-hmm. They were my playmates on the farm. But Christmas, of course, was very special Catholic, family, and we used to sing Christmas carols. But, and I describe this in my book, is my mother was ill with cancer, lying in bed. She couldn't join us for the occasion. And I'm almost getting tearful as I speak to you, because singing Christmas carols is associated with her illness and eventually her death.
Yeah.
But one of the more joyous Christmas carols is, and I'll just read the name here, Przybierzeli do Bethlehem.
Oh, well, there you are. I couldn't have done that. let's see what it sounds like.
Yes.
Here then, a Polish Christmas carol. Now, that was a genuine Polish Christmas carol requested by my guest, who is Jan Glazewski, on the program today. And his book that we are discussing is called Blood and Silver. And it's a sort of a treasure hunt. But you, Jan, are going to have to back announce that title again in Polish.
Przybierzeli do Bethlehem.
Okay. Thank you. I believe every word you say. How is your Polish? Can you still speak Polish?
Well, that's a nice question, because it was my first language.
Yes.
But after my father died and married a South African stepmother, we stopped speaking Polish at home. But when I went to Poland the very first time, when I was 21 as a student, it's also described in the book, I met my mother's sister. And that was a very emotional moment, because she reminded me so much of my late mother, who I hadn't seen since I was 7 years old. And I couldn't really speak to her very well. I just had a smattering of Polish. But my first or second night in her flat, I had this experience where suddenly Polish words tumbled out of my mouth. And it was like opening an old box in my head and all these little Polish things.
You also talk about that in your book.
Yes, I do.
The box, the opening a box and words falling out.
Yes. But everybody laughed at me because I then spoke Polish. But why they laughed was because I spoke, A, with this childlike accent, a childlike way, but also with an old-fashioned accent. Because this is now, you know, 20 years after my mother died and and the accents change, and so it's very quaint. And when I visit Poland, I find it comes back to me. I've done some Polish lessons. So I have a smattering of Polish I can speak. I can have a conversation over dinner in Polish. But I can't really understand when the radio's on and there's some complicated political discussion. I don't really understand all those.
Okay, okay. So you are still very much in touch with Poland and Polish life and possibly Polish politics.
Yes, I've been following the recent Polish presidential election, which I won't comment on.
Right. And also, as you said earlier, that area is changing almost daily. The borders and things with Ukraine and Russia, the USSR as it was then.
Yes.
And also, you mentioned, was it the southern part of Poland, which no longer exists?
Yes. It was incorporated after World War II into the Soviet Union, and now it's Ukraine. And that is where I had to go and look for the silver.
In the Ukraine. Before the war.
Good.
Jan, one of the things you mentioned about the firstborn in your family who died very young from hemophilia, but then apparently you also have hemophilia. How was that discovered and how come you've survived?
Well, when I was born in Powell Hospital, my parents immediately had me tested because Adam, my older brother, had died and I was diagnosed straight away with hemophilia. And then for some reason I've never understood, the doctor that delivered me, or maybe later, insisted I'd be circumcised. And apparently I bled almost to death. I had to have tubes of blood being infused in both my ankles where I still have the scars. So that is my first sort of life event, I guess, that's
yes,
important.
Yes. You then also write somewhere in the book about being, I think it was in East Germany, where some rather rough Russian soldiers took your medication, because you're on daily medication, aren't you? Something eight?
Factor eight. So the hemophiliacs lack a blood clotting factor called factor eight. So apparently 12 chemical processes happen to make your blood clot. But when it gets to number eight, the number eight soldiers don't appear. So there's a gap. So hemophiliacs worldwide, well, it's also been changed over my lifetime. I mean, it's amazing what's happened, technology. As a baby, I would have to get whole blood. Then later, when I was between 8 and 15, I got fresh frozen plasma. They realized it wasn't whole blood, it was plasma. And then they discovered, a Canadian researcher discovered, that if they spin plasma at a low temperature, it layers out and they can skim off one layer, which is the clotting factor, which hemophiliacs lack. And they can put people's donations into one little bottle and freeze dry it. And that's called cryoprecipitate in those days. Cryo being cold and precipitate as it precipitates in layers. So hemophiliacs were then, this was the beauty of the product, positive side was that it was kept at home in your fridge. And when you needed it, you didn't have to go to hospital. By this time, I was about 18, going to university sort of age. Before that, I'd always have to go to hospital. I spent much of my childhood in hospital, Chrudiske Hospital. But then this was homegrown and we could inject ourselves. So all my adult life, I've been injecting my veins. They're now shot from injecting this factor that we could speak a bit more about it, but time's running out.
Well, yes, because, I mean, it's the way you described it like that is very interesting, because one hears about hemophilia, unless you have direct contact with it or something to do with it, you don't really know what it's like. And since we're talking about your health then, apart from that, how then did you get HIV?
Well, plasma is generally manufactured in the United States, and I spent some time as a postgraduate student in London, and then they were manufacturing this factor, which is from human donations. And in the United States, it's not voluntary like in South Africa to give blood. They get blood from blood donations from people in jail or drug addicts. They make money out of it. And so there was a whole scandal in the late 80s worldwide of contaminated factor 8. And many, many hemophiliacs, including myself, were diagnosed. I was diagnosed in 1985 as HIV positive. And let me tell you, Rodney, in those days, it was not only a death sentence, but also a social stigma.
Very much so.
And so what I must recount, and which I do in the book, is there were no tests. My girlfriend and myself at the time started reading about this strange new disease affecting the three H's, the hemophiliacs, the homosexuals, and the Haitians. Why Haitians, I don't know, but that's what was reported. And I thought, I was 32 years old, I thought I would just make sure I'm clear. There were no tests available, but there was one test at Tygerberg Hospital, and I motored off there, and I saw the professor sent his son, who was just a newly qualified doctor, to meet me, not in his office. As I got out of the lift, he was waiting there for me, and he said, "Are you Jan Glazewski?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You have AIDS." And I was just obviously shattered. I didn't know what it was. I asked him, "Can you elaborate?" He went and got a book on immunology, and he said, "Take this book, but please return it." I never did. I threw it away. And he then recounted, he said, "There's this new scourge coming through Africa, and I'm newly graduated. I'm leaving the country. I'm going to America." And that was my first confrontation with living, what? Being diagnosed. Can you
but
believe it?
Not a very nice, gentle way of doing it, by the
not
sounds
at
of
all.
Things.
Not at all.
To come as such a shock on top of the hemophilia.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we need another piece of music after that story. So now we're into known territory here with Chopin, one of his nocturnes. Is there a connection here with anything?
Well, the Chopin is, again, from Polish background. It was played as a child before we moved to the new farm. But actually, maybe we must play something by Freddie Mercury.
All right.
Because that's associated with my condition, with my HIV. And I'd prefer maybe to play that at this stage.
You've asked for Who Wants to Live Forever?
Yes.
Which is an interesting choice, yes, considering your condition.
Yes, that's partly why it came through.
Okay.
I did think of my favorite of his, of course, is Barcelona. But
yes.
That's maybe too boisterous on a Sunday evening.
After what you've said, let's listen to Who Wants to Live Forever from Freddie Mercury.
Slips.
Well, that was Freddie Mercury from Queen and a famous song of his, Who Wants to Live Forever? An interesting question, actually, and it was the choice of my guest on People of Note this week, Jan Glazewski, whose new book, which we're talking about in some detail at the moment, called Blood and Silver, but also about Jan's various personal health issues like your haemophilia, the fact that you were told you had AIDS, HIV positive, and this whole business of your silver, this whole thing has turned into a treasure hunt. But the other thing that interests me a lot about your life, Jan, is your fascination with the environment. And you've written important stuff and done a lot of work in your academic career, haven't you, as an environmentalist?
Yes.
So how did that come into being?
Well, I did a conventional law degree. I then had to work off a government bursary, which I did in Pretoria. And then I did my articles in Johannesburg. And I then didn't want to live. I mean, I enjoyed living in Johannesburg, but I didn't want to stay there. I found the legal practice very stressful. So I decided to come back to Cape Town and perhaps join a law firm here. And I decided then to do something out of interest. Some friends of mine had done it, a master's in environmental studies. But let me go back one step. When I was working in Pretoria for the government, on holiday once I was in the Transkei and I bumped into a colleague from UCT days, just he was on holiday as well. And in the discussion, we were chatting away and he asked me, I said, I'm not happy working in the revenue department where I was posted to work off my bursary. He asked me, well, what do we do? If you're not happy there, what would you really like to do? And Rodney, I don't know why, but from where this came from, this was in about 1979, I just blurted out, I'd like to write a book on environmental law. And why that was strange then, because there were no books, at least in South Africa, on environmental law.
I was going to say, yes.
Yeah, there were no books
out
on
environmental law. Out of the blue.
Yeah, it was sort of out of the blue, inherent in me. I don't know where it came from. And many years later, that came to be. But part of the, coming back to where I was about the master's in environmental studies, I did that master's not with a view to career, just out of interest, because friends of mine had done it and they spoke of the degree very highly and interesting. I loved the course. It was not only classroom stuff, but going on field trips, learning about the fynbos and the geology and all that. And I just loved it. And of course, it's a multidisciplinary course. And I was the only law person in the class. There was an engineer, a teacher. There were about six or seven of us in the class, small. And I would get all the legal questions. And I started pondering all these questions. Why can this developer do this? And why is that farmer not adhering to the nature conservation laws in those days? And when I was completing the last leg of that course, my mini dissertation, a job advertised at the University of Cape Town, what was then called the Institute of Marine Law. And marine law is international law of the sea, so that didn't really interest me that much. And I saw there was an advert, and I knew that somebody had resigned because she was a law colleague of mine and was getting married and moving to Johannesburg. So I thought I'd go and look at the job, just out of interest, and say goodbye to this incumbent of the office. And when I got to her office, interestingly, had she not been there, probably wouldn't have tried again. She said to me, no, the professor is going to teach international law of the sea, but he wants somebody to teach the South African law of the coast. And I immediately, it struck me that that is environmental law, but of the coastline, which has got a lot of pressures from development, marine oil pollution spills, plastic pollution, all kinds of environmental happenings happen at the coast. So then the whole advert took on a different picture. And I was so keen to get that job. And I interviewed for it. And I don't know if I didn't interview that well. But anyway, I was very fortunate to get that job, which was really a life-changing thing for me because I never went back to the real world of legal practice. And I developed my interest in environmental law. And if I can carry on that, what was fortunate is while I was researching to prepare my lecture notes on coastal zone law, which wasn't a recognized subject, I had to kind of do it from scratch, I started keeping a file when I came across articles on environmental rights. And I put that in what I called my dream file. One day, South Africa might, you know, change and so there were environmental rights sort of in the back of my filing cabinet. And sure enough, what happened in 1989, somebody, a colleague, phoned me out of the blue. in what was then Southwest Africa. And then they said, we're developing a new constitution. We want something about the environment. And could you help us? And I said, how many months have I got? And they said, 3 weeks. And fortunately, I had this dream file. I cobbled together a memorandum. I sent it up. I had these materials from different international sources on environmental rights, environmental constitutions. And then Namibia got something in its – it went independent in February 1990. And it, in its new constitution, it got something there. And what happened – listeners will know what else happened in February 1990 – Nelson Mandela was released.
Yes. quite a big date. Monday yes. date, yeah.
And then I realized that South Africa was going to go the same route.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I spent all my energy on researching environmental rights. And the dean of the law faculty then, Hugh Corder, I cobbled together, I cobbled together a memorandum. Hugh Corder was going up to Johannesburg to the Kempton Park negotiations, and I slipped him something on his car windscreen on a rainy day. I put it in plastic, some memorandum about environmental rights, and he put it to the Committee on the Bill of Rights, and we have an environmental right in our Bill of Rights, which then was a very unusual thing, but today, obviously, it's very relevant and useful.
It seems to me that you had lots of pleasant coincidences, and obviously an inquiring mind, like getting out of law, going to the environment, ending up in our constitution somehow. Yes. Getting rid of, well, not getting rid of, but dealing with the HIV diagnosis and also hemophilia. And all through this life of yours, presumably, was this desire to write it all down.
Rodney, you've used a very interesting expression. You said all of these coincidences.
Yes.
If you look at the preface of my book, if you open it now, you'll see I quote somebody who said, there's no such thing as a coincidence. That's the sort of, you know, in the front pages of the book.
There is no such thing as a coincidence. Anonymous.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, dear. Then I said the wrong thing.
No, you said the right thing because it puts me on track.
There you go.
My life has been full of coincidences. But the question is why? What? A friend says you make your coincidences happen. That's, I think, what's – you manufacture them.
Well, congratulations is what I can
Thank
say.
Thank you.
Now we're going to have another piece of music. It's called Weeping. By Bright Blue, what is this all about?
Well, it brings me back to the late 80s, the state of emergencies. We all felt, well, not all of us, but I wasn't directly involved with the struggle. I've sympathized with the struggle. I couldn't demonstrate at university because I was a hemophiliac. If I got one bash on the head, I would be tickets. And Weeping is a song about the struggle. And it's just, it's quite melancholic. And I just love that music.
But as the night came round, I heard it slow.
That was called Weeping by Bright Blue, and it was another choice of my guest, Jan Glazewski, talking about what seems to me to be quite a fascinating life, full of coincidences. And Jan, as you pointed out to me after I said that just now, you said on the front page of your book is an anonymous quote, "There is no such thing as a coincidence." So you're proving yourself wrong here and there, or maybe you're not. Talking about the environment, I was intrigued to hear that you now live in McGregor, which is a great favorite of many people and is a great favorite for people wanting to go to the poetry festival there, to that lovely garden, Tremenos. Is this a place that means something to your soul because you started planting vegetables and all sorts of things there, a real farmer?
Yes, indeed. That's a good expression, a place for my soul. I first went to McGregor for the first time about 5 years after I started my career at UCT. I suddenly got tired of dealing with books and computers, and I got this urge to work with my hands. And then I discovered through some friends that a woman ran a pottery course there, and a residential pottery course for a week where you boarded at her place, and there was a group of us. And I loved the pottery course. And I loved many other things of McGregor, including becoming acquainted with Tremenos, which is a kind of a retreat, an eclectic. It's not one religion. It's Buddhist, Catholicism, Judaism, all in one, run by a wonderful man called Billy Kennedy. And that also drew me to McGregor. You know, I grew up on farms, the rural lifestyle, the farm trucks, the tractors, all of those things resonated with me as opposed to the busy city living. But I only started living there after I retired.
Okay, but then by that stage you were married.
Yes.
Is it Louise that you were married to?
Yes, correct.
And yeah, she was quite keen to move with you to McGregor.
She wasn't that keen, actually.
Okay.
Because my HIV, I didn't get married for a long time. I didn't marry my girlfriend at the time when I was diagnosed. I spent a lot of my life alone and getting very depressed. I met Louise when I was at the age of 59, and she's an architect. The last part of my career at UCT, we lived together in Newlands, married. But I always hankered to go to McGregor, and straight after I retired, I started going there, apart from going to the Ukraine to look for silver.
Yes.
But I started going there, and she would come rather reluctantly, because she had a busy architectural practice, and you know her life was here. And it was COVID that turned the tide, because I said, let's spend the, you know, remember the first announcement of COVID was restrictions for 3 weeks.
That's right. And we all thought it would be over in 3 weeks.
Yes.
How wrong we
and Louise,
were.
I said to Louise, just come to McGregor for the three weeks instead of living where we were in Newlands. She said, sure. But after the 3 weeks, it became longer a few months later. And then she became so enchanted with McGregor that she decided to live there permanently with me.
Okay. I think let's take another, you know, we've not spoken yet about the actual treasure hunt, which I want to come to now, but let's have another piece of music. And you've chosen one of Poland's most famous composers, Chopin, one of his nocturnes. Is there a special reason for this?
Well, it's partly from our childhood. There was Chopin often played in our household, especially before I moved in with my stepfamily. But partly as I get older, I'm more drawn to Poland. And when I go there, I go to Chopin concerts, and I love the nocturnes, and for that reason, I've chosen this one. Thank you.
That was the Nocturne No. 2, E-flat, Opus 9, No. 2 by Chopin, another choice of Jan Glazewski, my guest talking about his book Blood and Silver. And I said the main climax of this is to talk about the actual treasure hunt. Tell us how you did that. You were determined, were you, to go and find the silver that your father had buried?
Yes, I always had this yearning from childhood about this. I don't know why, but I had this deep inside me that I must at least go and look for this hidden treasure, which my father mentioned. Shortly before he died, I got him to draw me a map, about a year or two before he died. And in the accompanying instructions, how to get there, etc., remarkable. He wrote this map 50 years after he left. It was so accurate. Well, his memory was accurate. It was difficult. Anyway, the last sentence of his instructions said, "You must find our silver and my hunting guns." And when I read that, it was kind of a directive, but I just, something in my stomach just turned and I kind of let out a wail, because the feeling of our silver somehow made me realize that somewhere back in Poland, I have a family, you know, my ancestors came from there. It's our place, a kind of a yearning, which my late mother always yearned for Poland, actually. And then his hunting guns were, I suppose, a kind of directive to find the male part, you know, of passing it on.
Yes.
So that kind of motivated me.
And so did you literally set off into the bushes?
Not quite. I made four trips. It was only on the fourth trip which I seriously went and looked for it. The first trip was just to get acquainted with Ukraine, because it's now the Soviet Union obviously dissolved in 1990. We weren't allowed there before. My father could never return after World War II to communist Russia or whatever. But so I made a few trips, once with my sisters to show them our father's farm, which he started farming, and with my French cousins, because my father had three brothers. One of them ended up in France. I have French cousins. But I always kind of speculated about where it might be. There's the forest. But it was only in the last time, the fourth time, that I actually went to search for it. And then I realized I had to get a metal detector people, and through a series of coincidences that are described in the book, I found a Ukrainian, half Polish, half Ukrainian woman. In the book, she's called Alina. That's not her real name, but she helped with finding metal detectors and metal detector men, Ukrainians.
Right. And you've got pictures of that. You've got nice pictures in this book as well,
yes,
by the way. And there's a picture here of a barn on a farm still standing after 8 years. That's presumably in Poland, in Ukraine.
It's in Ukraine. It's on. More importantly, it's on my grandfather's farm. It was the barn that my father drew on the map.
Oh, right. To give you a clue where all this was.
Yeah.
And you also say somewhere in the book that the map wasn't that clear.
No, it was scrawled on
okay.
Rodney, it's amazing that I ever found this, because the map was just scratches on a piece of foolscap paper.
How did you find it? Obviously, the metal detector helped, and you thought there's something here, and you
started
digging.
So the map that he gave me, he put where the house was, because it was destroyed by the Russians, because all landowners' houses were destroyed. So I had to find the foundations of the house, which my niece Leila, who came along, she assisted in that. I couldn't find the foundations on my own. I made a mistake with the with my bearings. She got it right. But what my father did, he wrote a dotted line. He said, from the yard garden wall, you must walk 100 meters across a field, down a slope, and where the forest starts, you must dig. I mean, how vague is that?
That's rather vague, yes.
It's like being on the contour path on Table Mountain saying, walk down towards those gum trees and start digging.
No.
You don't know after eight. This was 80 years after it was buried.
Yes.
You don't know if the forest had receded or if it encroached. Had no clue. I'm still amazed I found it. And I think there's some mystical reason for this.
Was it a great excitement? Did you clink? Was it literally digging and then you clunk
exactly
on some silver?
Exactly.
Something metallic.
Something metallic, but after a few false starts, because you also got some bleeps. But it was certainly that. And then there was this doubt whether it was ours. When I say ours, our silver, it might be in something else. And eventually we pulled stuff out and it became more evident. Saw the family crests on the various cutlery.
That's right. And there are photographs of all that in your book as well.
And then we found what is really the most important, although we found about 25 kilos of silver for for me, what is most important was the my father's breakfast spoon with his name engraved on it.
Ah, yes. A beautiful
christening
scheme,
yeah.
And such was the treasure found. The treasure hunt ended there. But before
before
we end, Jan, and before we run out of time completely, I was very intrigued to see that your book is being adapted into a play that's been on at the Baxter in the course of July, directed by none other than Fred Abrams, sir. How do you feel about that? And did you write the play? Did you write the script? Did you transcribe it?
No, that is almost another coincidence of such, is that my nephew's mother-in-law was at lunch with dinner with a guy called David Muller, who's an actor. He does monologues. A small talk between the two of them over at some dinner at the Owl Club. He then approached me out of the blue, and he said he heard about my book, my Search for Silver. Could he make it into a play? So he wrote the script with assistance of Fred Abrams. So I never went out to look for this, but it came sort of to me.
Coincidence.
Yes,
you see,
correct.
It's going to be very interesting. It opens on the 8th of July at the Baxter Theatre. So it's going to be something really different. Blood and Silver is described here as a gripping one-man play based on the memoir of environmental lawyer Jan Glazewski, who embarked on this perilous journey. So thank you for sharing so much with us. And we're going to end with Imagine. And now, apart from the fact that this is a very beautiful, thought-provoking song, why have you chosen it to end?
Rodney, the Beatles were always my favorites in my growing up teenage years. John Lennon was a kind of a hero. At the millennium, on the first day of the millennium, on the 1st of January 2000, I sort of thought about, what is the first music I'm going to play? I chose Imagine as my first track that I played in the new century. And I've chosen it now again because I think his words are so, so much more relevant in the chaos that we are in today in the world.
Let's end with that. And I was talking to Jan Glazewski. His book is called Blood and Silver, which is available now. And the play is going to open at the Baxter on the 8th of July with the actor David Muller in the role of Jan. Jan, thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you, Rodney. Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.